Welcome to the Superhero of Love podcast. I am Bridget Fonger. I wrote a book called Superhero of Love, Heal Your Broken Heart and Then Go Save the World. That book is going to be out in January 2019, but I didn't want to wait until that time to start talking to superheroes of love. And guess what? Here's the news. You are a superhero of love. And through talking to other superheroes like yourself, tapping into that little superhero inside of you, I'm hoping that you and I and all of us start feeling more and more like superheroes of love, meaning that we love and are loved more than ever before. So welcome. Let's get this party started. So I have to do a proper introduction here for this interview with John Billingsley, who is an extraordinary activist, and we're going to talk about how he takes care of his heart and other hearts through activism. But we started the interview with a bang, and I just need to warn you that the bang is full of profanity. So if anybody doesn't like profanity, you may want to skip to the next podcast in the line. But John is an extraordinary actor. He played Dr. Phlox on Star Trek Enterprise, and he has been in just about everything else. You have seen him. If you go and Google him, you will see his vast resume. I loved him in True Blood. But he's an amazing actor and who has turned his beautiful heart toward activism. And that's what this interview is about. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks for coming.
Don't worry about anything because I can edit anything out after this. So.
Cocksucker, cocksucker, cocksucker.
Oh my God, that was so good. Okay, let me start.
Don't edit that. Don't edit that. Leave that. Leave that to the world to hear. Terrific.
Okay.
But you know what? I don't have Roseanne Barr's career. What's the worst anybody could do to me? You are no longer going to be allowed to play tertiary characters on bad television shows. You're banned.
All right, let's start with that, actually. How do you feel about that?
There's a whole new profession. We need Twitter-seeders, like interceders, people who are professionally hired to, like, just wrestle your ass to the ground and sit on you to shut you the fuck up. I swear to God, it's just, it's amazing. It's like somebody posted, they said, the only bar that she really was given, I think ABC should fire ABC, the only bar that ABC basically said was, please don't imply that black people are apes. Couldn't pass the bar. It's like, wow. I mean, really. It's like a dog. It's like, look, Spot, do not eat the feces. Oh, Spot. Come on. Well, I'm not taking you out for walks anymore. It's just fucking amazing. I mean, what did they think was going to happen when they hired her? It's like, Jesus Christ.
I had dinner with the I don't know her exact title, VP in marketing, the night before, and we were actually talking about the show just literally the night before, and she was making the point. I hadn't seen the show at all. Did you see it at all?
No, I was asked to audition for it, and I said not in a million years. I had
affection
for the original show,
but they didn't. But they didn't touch on. Oh, were you on the original show?
No. I had affection for it in terms of as a viewer.
Yeah.
I appreciated the original show. I mean, you know, at that point, you still were aware that Roseanne Barr had some real psychological issues, but you kind of plugged your ears because you thought it was mostly about the cast and production strife. I shouldn't say cast strife. It was mostly the writer's room strife.
Yeah.
It was only really after the fact that you began to realize that, you know, she was fairly egregious in terms of her politics.
Yeah.
And her racial politics, let's face it. I mean, this is, you know, I think if it was about, for all the atrocities, you know, about Pizzagate and Democrats are child molesters and George Soros is a Nazi, if it wasn't for the racist remark, ABC would still have kind of done a little la 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 la, which
I heard that she only did the politic thing. They only dealt with that the first episode.
Well, it depends upon how you. For instance, this is one of the things. I've not watched the show. I would read about it because it's such a cultural touchstone. But in the episode in which she supposedly has concerns about a Muslim family next door, and then when she gets to know them, realizes they're okay. To my mind, you know, there is some pernicious political content in that episode. For one thing, there's a reference to the fact that it's the illegals that took Dan's job away, which is reinforcing a standard-issue conservative trope that the brown people are taking all the work, which is, of course, a bullshit lie.
Yeah.
But also the idea that it's not prejudice if you're nice to the particular brown person, black person, Muslim person that lives next door. That frees you to kind of condemn the class as long as you're nice to the individual. Which is another, I think, classic conservative trope. So to the extent that I think what was being sort of slipped in, and this, even though the writers were liberal, as she says, to my mind, what's being slipped in are some fairly pernicious lies that are reinforcing the lies we're being told by our government every day. So, yeah, I object. I haven't said that. I didn't see it. I only read about it.
Okay, now we started with a bang. Now I'm going to take a step forward.
Cocksucker. I'll just, anytime you want a bridge, I'll just say that. How about that?
No, but I want
it's
to.
Like an ellipsis.
John Bill.
Nobody's listening at this point.
No.
I'm never listening to another Bridget Fogger podcast again. This is outrageous. Who is this man? I've never even heard of him.
Oh my God. But you are a phenom in the Star Trek world, of course. But so tell us a little bit about that, but then I want to, you know, immediately venture into the how you moved into politics. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm going to have to argue with both those premises. Not a phenom. I was on the show that killed the franchise, Enterprise. The lowest rated, least successful, and least popular show in Star Trek history. I'm not really in politics. I have always had an interest in politics, and I've been doing a little tiny bit to help out in a political campaign. I am very interested in volunteerism, which is something that I've kind of been putting a lot of time and energy in the last couple of years. But that, in a way, sort of transcends the political and has more to do with the community involvement.
Okay, so let's stop there. Yeah, right, great. Okay, so I think it was like 10 or 12 years ago, I was in your and Bonnie's living room for a group meeting of volunteers, and it was like the baby version of what you're doing right now, and it was so incredibly exciting because both you and Bonnie are really, you know, my book, this podcast is heart related, right? So things that are going to that could possibly help heal a pain in your heart. So yes, and that's why I wanted you to come on the call, because the way that you dealt from the outside looking in with your heart pain around the election was to get immediately into action and start push, which I'm going to let you talk about. But I need to first acknowledge you about that. I have felt like you are a person who takes care of other people's hearts in such a beautiful way, in service, in community, in like I am in awe of how many friends and colleagues that you have. You literally know everybody that I know, and times a thousand. So you create community, but you create this community that it's a truly loving community. I mean, I will never forget those meetings in your living room. And everywhere you go, I mean, I saw you mingling at our friend Allie's book launch, and you treat every single person that you meet as if they are the most special person. And that conversation, in other words, your heart is always engaged. And so that's why I wanted you to be on this podcast, and specifically to talk about the heart pain around politics that many of us have. So.
Well, that's very sweet of you to say. Thank you for all that. That's very kind. I'm not going to be able to say cocksucker, cocksucker, cocksucker anymore in this conversation, because now I'm going to have to be very earnest. And So, yes, I did. After the election, I mean, of course, it was a devastating blow to many of us. But then history is full of devastating blows. I mean, that is the nature, unfortunately, of the collision of values that will always be with us. There are people for whom tribalism and us versus themism and racism and fear dominate the nature of how they see the world. And there are people for whom inclusion and growth, and this sounds awfully Manichaean, and I don't mean it to. I mean, I think that there are people who are led around by the noses, you know, in all candor, mm-hmm. because I don't think our education system is very good, and I think people can be easily gulled and fooled. I don't think everybody who voted for Donald Trump is a racist. I don't think everybody who is on the right is a damned fool. I think, unfortunately, there are a lot of venal, evil people who are leading a lot of people who should know better by the noses, and I've certainly, you know, lost some friends in saying that. But
don't you think,
reaction,
I mean, the being led, the being able to be led, don't you think that that's out of, because there's fear? I mean, because when you're afraid.
Absolutely. I think, and that's historically how demagogues work. And I think when you consider that there are more refugees in the world right now than we have ever seen since the Second World War anyway, and that's only going to get worse. Climate refugeeism is only going to get worse. And I think refugeeism and the fear of the other and the fear of incursions into your land and your territory and into your nation drives fascism and drives authoritarianism. I mean, we see Australia where people are rounded up who are trying to enter Australia from, say, Indonesia, and they're kept on an island in what is essentially a glorified concentration camp. We see now people separated from their children, punishing children, for God's sake. To my mind, this kind of fear of the other is what is unfortunately driving so much of our politics and driving so much of our world, that for me, my reaction to the election was we've got to find in any small, small way we can, a means to reconnect people and get back to community building. And I think that's one of the problems in an atomized age with Facebook and Twitter and all of us spending hours online. We don't do enough together. We don't work together. We don't volunteer enough together. Those are gross generalizations, I know. But I think mm-hmm. the only way to make a difference in the world is to gather mm-hmm. and find something you can commit yourself to that is about community building. To me, that is a political gesture. I think that's how people get a political consciousness, when they invest in their communities and feel that something is at stake worth fighting for.
That's beautiful. I'll
say one last thing, and then I won't interrupt you.
No.
Some of what I was always driven by was a book called Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam, a sociologist, who essentially said there was a time, and in part it's because before urbanism, in small villages and towns, the expectation was when you were born, you were going to live in that community and you were going to be part of that community and you were going to join the Shriners or the Elks and you were going to be on the bowling team and you were going to go to church and you were going to be in the PTA. I'm not an old-fashioned person. I'm a modernist, but I do believe that some sense of being born into a network or a web of responsibility mm-hmm. has been, we have lost. And mm-hmm. as much as David Brooks can make me want to blow my brains out sometimes, I do think he speaks about this, and he's a conservative commentator in the New York Times, but I do mm-hmm. think he speaks about that in a way that resonates for me, and I think it is one of the few ways that people can make a difference in their community.
Can you repeat the name of the book one more time, Bowling
Alone? Yeah,
or?
It's called Bowling Alone, and it was written well before the digital age. And he's gone on to have a very interesting career as a sociologist, but that was kind of a seminal book at the time, kind of predicting the level of enemy and isolation and loneliness. I mean, this has been sort of, you know, these books have been written since beginning of the 20th century, really, particularly since the end of the Second World War. In a weird way, I don't think what we're experiencing is a new thing. I think a lot of the sense of fracturedness we are experiencing in our society is very much what a lot of people from the end of the First World War were warning was going to be the modern condition of the modern state.
Yeah.
I think we reap a lot of those consequences now.
So tell us about PUSH.
Yeah, pushes people unwilling to sit on their haunches, and I don't make any great claims for it. It really was. It's not a not-for-profit. It's not.
I'm sorry, but I just have to because this is an oral thing. I just have to say. We just have to repeat that. PUSH
yes.
is the name of the organization that John started, and it stands for People Unwilling to Sit on Their Haunches. I'm sorry, but it's just hilarious, and it's really, really good.
Oh.
I had to repeat that.
Thank you. I
you said it really
that,
fast,
yes.
and it's too hilarious
yes.
and passionate.
Thank you. Yes, I realize sometimes that Bonnie will sort of shake me and say, slow down, slow down. One has, unfortunately, a lot to say in a limited time in this world.
Let's give some context to that too. I think that you're feeling the fire is so burning brightly under your haunches right now because we are less than a week away from a big election day as well. So. You're particularly on fire right now. You're always on fire, but you're particularly on fire now.
Well, the irony is, and I'll say that when I kind of started the push, I was basically just thinking, geez, how can I play a small part in trying to help people identify what their particular activist bliss is? Because I don't
activist
think...
Activist bliss. I love that. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's one of the problems is that what we tend to do as individuals is we sort of say, this is the most important thing, and if you're not doing what I'm doing, you know, you don't get it, i.e.,
mm-hmm.
you've got to be working on a political campaign, or you've got to be working for social justice, or you've got to be working to alleviate poverty, if you've got to be, you know. But the reality is, of course, there are 18 bazillion things that are worth doing in this world, and you can't do them all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm inclined to think that one of the things that we can do to help each other is to sort of interrogate each other in a friendly way to find out what it is that you might be doing that might interest you, that might lead you to get more involved in your community, as opposed to doing things you feel like you're supposed to do that don't really make you happy.
Mm-hmm.
So in getting people together, the impulse was not to try and create a big elaborate architecture so much as to create a means via consistent social functions, for instance, creation of a Facebook page on which people could post active intention posts. Here's something you can do. Here's something you can volunteer for. Hey, I'm gonna, anybody want to join me and do this with me? To kind of push the doing of things and to say, let's not judge it. Let's not try and prioritize it. Let's just say there's a world of shit that you could get involved in and keep sharing with people.
Mm-hmm.
What I found for myself was that although my intention was to try and spearhead and prod and push and nag and cajole and you know, essentially be a pest until I lost all my friends, that... In practice, I myself had things I wanted to do, and I found that those things, particularly, as it turned out, working to help a local food kitchen survive and sustain itself and grow, took up so much of my time and energy that I didn't really quite have the time and energy to be a proselytizer for the general purpose of
mm-hmm.
the organization. So in certain respects, push... It writ large has kind of receded as I've been doing a lot more work with the Greater West Hollywood Food Coalition, which has been feeding people for 30 years. We feed 200 people a night, 7 nights a week. And a lot of folks were interested in helping to feed people, and I've kind of organized a lot of them into helping that organization grow. So...
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I started doing was working on a political campaign, and I've been working with a wonderful woman named Jess Phoenix, who's running for Congress in the 25th District here in Los Angeles, in the Los Angeles area. And that's been another effort of mine, and I've been kind of engaged in doing some groundwork and canvassing and phone banking, et cetera, to nowhere near the same extent that some of my friends have been doing who've really thrown themselves into that world. That is not the world that I can survive in on a day-to-day basis, though. So for me, the overarching point of push was to say, you know, maybe it's environment, maybe it's gun safety, maybe you have a particular tactical bent and you want to try and get the boycotts going for a little while. I was trying to get something going to encourage people to call their representatives or to call representatives all over the country and you know, speak their minds. Whatever it is that floats your boat, the important thing is putting your hands on the, to mix my metaphors, the New Yorker always yelled at you about that, put your hands on the rope. It's a perpetual tug-of-war. You don't have to have your hands on the rope 24/7. But on some level, some rope requires you. And just kind of, you know, adjust your sights and make that more of your life.
Wow. On some level, some rope requires you. I love that quote. Okay, so you said this really fast, too, so I just want to clarify it. It's Jess Phoenix, like the Rising Phoenix, and in CA 25, in District 25, is one of the districts that, in full disclosure, I also had a fundraiser for her here. I adore her. I think she is absolutely, unequivocally the best person running there. But you're also passionate about flipping blue.
I mean, this is the gag. I mean, I support Jess. If those folks who may be listening who aren't familiar with the peculiarities of California politics, we have a so-called jungle primary, in which Democrats and Republicans and Greens and Independents all run on the same ballot in the primaries, and the top two candidates go to the general election in November. There are districts,
no matter what their
If two Democrats finish first and second, it's two Democrats. If two Republicans finish first and second, it's two Republicans. In the 25th district, there is a Republican incumbent. There wasn't another Republican on the ballot. So although there are multiple Democrats running, there's no danger that a Democrat won't be in the race. Jess, who I love, is the underdog candidate. And, in all candor, I'm not trying to sell anybody. I think she is the best candidate because I think she's articulate, brilliant. She's a volcano scientist. She is a climate change authority. She kind of poo-poos the use of that word, but it's true.
She's being recognized. She's been on CNN, and even Stephen Colbert last week mentioned her.
My feeling in supporting her was that I thought that she didn't have the money or the infrastructure probably to win, but that she would raise her own profile and become a voice nationally that we need. Somebody who speaks to evidentiary standards, somebody who can articulate science to the general community, kind of like a Bill Nye without the patina of being an entertainer.
Right.
We
should also note that she was also in high school at the time of Columbine, not at Columbine, but down the street, and so was personally lost people to that shooting.
Well, she's got an amazing story. Daughter of two FBI agents.
Daughter of two FBI agents.
Yeah.
That's my favorite thing.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
bilingual, bisexual. Very, very open and out, and a very brave, courageous woman. But here's the thing: because for me, the ultimate goal is to elect Democrats. If we are to stop the authoritarian bent and drift and direction in this country, we need to start repudiating the Republican Party. So if she loses, and I support her, and I'm canvassing for her, and I'm working for her. But if she loses, I will immediately pivot and be as full-throated in support of whoever wins the nod in that district as I can be, because they are all good candidates. They are all progressive. They are all smart. They each have extraordinary backgrounds, and any of them on their worst day would be better than the incumbent on his best day. The incumbent who wants to eliminate Planned Parenthood, the incumbent who is, I'm not going to mention his name, screw him, cocksucker, who is a climate change denialist who sits on the House Science Committee, who's never met a gun or a bomb or a war plane that he didn't want to fund. To my mind, the most important thing is to not engage in a kind of internecine brawl that loses us the chance of reclaiming some of these seats. And unfortunately, some of the districts in California where there are multiple Republicans on the primary ballot and multiple Democrats, there is a risk that we might end up seeing two Republicans run for the general election, just as we may very well see two gubernatorial candidates who are Democrats running. I'm not a huge fan of the jungle primary. I think it was kind of a mistake for California to go in that direction. I don't think it actually – I love aspects of what California did, putting redistricting in the hands of an independent commission, for instance. I think if there's anything we could do to save our country's ass, it would be to take gerrymandering out of the hands of the politicians, put drawing districts into the hands of nonpartisan.
Yeah, and isn't that what Obama and
they're fighting for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're fighting for it. I mean, it's a, you know, it's a heavy lift, as are so many things that are essentially structural fixes. I mean, you know, campaign finance reform, you try and talk about that to anybody for more than 3 minutes, and their ears bleed. Everybody agrees that you shouldn't have big money in politics, but when you get into the nitty-gritty of how and what it means, it's like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
You know, I think, which is, I think, what the problem that Democrats have is that Democrats, you know, for all they're scored about not having a message, the problem is that Democrats do have a message. It just is an intelligent message, which means it's a complicated message, which means that people have to be willing to listen to it. You want to talk about health care, you have to talk about how insurance companies work and what the problems are in the system. And, you know, within 30 seconds, it's just people are making the white noise in their head. It's a lot easier for a Republican to say, death panel, death panel, death panel. You know, that's one of the problems that Roosevelt said, one of my favorite Roosevelt quotes, and I'm paraphrasing. He said that the conservatives get four whacks at the pinata for every one that the liberals get, because conservatives can incite people based on fear and Democrats have to rally people based on hope.
Oh, wow.
And, you know,
amazing quote.
Speaking
of that, of inciting people with fear versus hope, I want to circle back to something, because this is very heart-related, the us versus them thing, because
yeah.
I even have it myself, right? Like, I can get incited in such a way as to think they.
Yeah, you know, I know. Yeah. I know. It's pernicious. I do.
So how do you take care of that? I mean, how do you manage that in yourself, or how do you manage that when you're confronted with someone who is in that space, they're stuck in the us versus them in a conversation? How do you manage, bring them through to the other side?
Oh, I don't know. You know, it's really hard. I mean, I'll say this. There's a wonderful, I read a lot, and I kind of feel like one of the great things that literature has to teach us is that we're all screwed up, fucked up human beings, and that none of us have an answer to the problem of what it is to be human. We don't live very long. You know, the best of us make it to 90. There's a hell of a lot to learn. We'd learn a fraction of it. So I think, you know, first, I forgive myself my trespasses. I forgive other people their trespasses as best I can, except insofar where I feel like somebody, some innocent person, is getting hurt or injured, at which point you simply have to speak up and say, no, there is a line, you know, no matter how. I'll say this. Trump had a son of a bitch for a parent, and doubtless that guy had a son of a bitch for a parent, and I suspect son of a bitchery goes back in the Trump fucking family for umpteen generations. He was bred to be a bigot. He was bred to be a narcissist. He was bred to be an asshole. There's a part of me that feels like more to be pitied than censored, except the damage he's doing is too great to allow that to stop us from rising up and saying, get out. And unfortunately, it's a really hard thing to hold those two strains, more to be pitied than censored, and get the fuck out, in your brain at the same time. David Grossman, who I think is a marvelous Israeli novelist, wrote a book called C:Under Love. C:Under Love. And it's about a guy whose parents lived through the Holocaust, and he can't not live in fear and hate. And he knows he can't live that way. I mean, he's growing up now in a modern Israel, and Israel at the time in the 60s, you know, his point of view in the 70s is a nation that is trying to leave behind some of the psychic wound. And he realizes that that is a vital project, but he doesn't know how to do it. And he talks about, how do I kill the little Nazi in me? The little Nazi that wants to respond to Nazism by becoming just as violent, just as fuck you-ish, just as, you know, as finger-pointy as the people you're nominally fighting against. It's a gorgeous book that asks the question you just asked. And I kind of find, for me, I go to books. I go to literature. I go to the arts. It is the arts exist to teach us to be better human beings by making us recognize we are all fucked up on some level. And I don't know. I lose that battle inside of my head all the time. Sometimes I win it, sometimes I lose it.
Well, I think that one of your other tactics is activism, you know, getting into action. So it's like, because if we stay in the neighborhood between our two ears, that's much more dangerous neighborhood than.
Yeah, and I got to say, I really admire people. I mean, I hold no great brief for myself. I so admire people like a Steve Pearson, who's working locally on a swing left campaigns, and Jason Berlin, who's quit his job and giving all he's got to electing progressives. It's all he does, 24/7. I really admire people who devote their life to that. I found for myself that the political arena, although it really interests me, I can't sustain a life like that. It's easier for me to put my energies and passion into helping people who are down and out. And so I put more time and energy into the Food Coalition. But I will say, this is what I am proud of, is my wife and I started a volunteer driving group. It's called the Pickup Artists. There are 42 of us, and we pick up food at studios and catering companies. We pick up food from CAA, Tinder, all over town, and we take the food to the Food Coalition. Last week, we picked up 2,500 pounds of food a week.
Oh, my gosh.
Picked up 2,500 pounds. That's our record. But we want to keep growing that group and to see if we can start bringing food to more of the organizations in town and pick up from – it's a small thing. You know, it doesn't hold a candle to what some of the – you know, like Wolfgang Puck has an amazing thing where he has fleets of trucks that pick up from various restaurants and studios all over town. They're saving food.
I didn't know about that. That's so great that you're telling us that. That's great.
There's a ton of – this is what heartens me. When you start digging into something, for me it became food rescue. For somebody else it may be environmentalism. It's stunning to find the number of very cool and wonderful people who are out there doing great fucking work. It's inspiring. Mm-hmm. And you know, you talk about if I have a lot of friends, it's because I go out and meet a lot of people who I love so much for what they're doing that I just it's like I want to be your pal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because people are doing amazing things. That's the answer. I think you're right. It's if you are doing shit, you're meeting cool people. It keeps you buoyant. And you have to be buoyant to fight back. You can't be mired in depression. I have friends who I adore who basically got kicked to the floor after the election, and they haven't really gotten up yet.
Yeah, I know. That's why I want to deal with this. I'm going to keep having interviews of this type because I do too. There are still people that have not are you talking about male friends? I'm just curious because I have so many women friends who were kicked in the gut and it hasn't they haven't
it takes
recovered.
It, you know what? It takes a different form. What I find is some of my female friends, it's a little bit more like I'm down and out and I can't get up and these bastards have won and the world is
mm-hmm.
over. My male friends, I think, you know, there's this incredible rage, but it's channeled into, you know, I would do more, but I got my work. And
mm-hmm.
so, and their work in the private sector, you know, their mm-hmm. their work as producers or actors, and I don't mean to point fingers. I'm old enough to have not, I don't really need to work, so it's unfair for me to
mm-hmm.
say to anybody else that their job shouldn't come
mm-hmm.
first. But I think men are more likely to take their energy, their anger, their rage, and they put it back into their career. And I've seen, you know, this is a horrible, perhaps an unfair gender. I mean, even as the words are coming out of my mouth, I'm kind of regretting it. Just in my own personal experience, some of the women I know, yes, have been a little bit more like, I'm just too fucking depressed to move.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really, having said that, there are more women running for office than at ever any point in time in history. Some of the, you know, the women I know who are the most inspirational people in my life are like fucking kicking ass and taking names.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
that is a gross, you know.
Generalization, right. Yeah. No,
yeah.
And I'm making it too, but there is a, I think there are some generalizations though that can be made. Like the trigger for the male generally is to get angry about it. And the trigger for many, many of my women friends is also, and I still, is to get angry as well. And I still have a lot of women friends that are still in the anger and get more angry every day. But every day the news hits them like a punch. And so that's not necessarily, I think, healthy or helpful, but I get it. And
I think it's also that, you know, just as, I mean, the nature of the punch, if I was a black man or I was Hispanic or I was a woman or I was gay, it would be a hell of a fucking hard, I mean, I'm a white guy, you know. For me, it's easy to have a certain kind of, I'm not saying I have emotional detachment. I mean, I have the same level of rage as everybody. But the reality, my ox isn't getting gored the way the way a lot of other people's oxes are getting gored. So,
well, and you know, I think the even if you,
except insofar as I live on the fucking planet and we're all going to be underwater.
That's what I was going to say, right? Our Mother Earth is being gored, so
yeah,
and we can all feel that as an attack on us. But yeah, that's that's precisely why I am. You know, like every week I try to do something. I've been just like profoundly busy, but I try to do something, even if it's just give some money to a blue candidate. But that's why I did the Just fundraiser, and I've been trying to hook Just Phoenix up with as many people as I possibly can, because that makes me feel less gored. You know,
I think it does, and I think that's the key too. It can't be. You know, we can't turn around and ask everybody and their brother to suddenly be balls to the wall 24/7. My new life is activism. That isn't how people are. We have lives. We have kids. We have obligations. I kind of feel like it's about just saying, it's like if you imagine, I use the tug of war, but I also think it's like you have your finger on a dial in your life. You know, you can dial up your passion for your work. You can dial up your commitment to your relationship. You can dial up the time you spend with your kids. You can dial up how much you read or go to the gym. I just kind of feel like we just kind of need to have a little bit more of a sense of there's a dial surrounding our commitment to our communities that we can just dial it up a little bit. Doesn't mean you can't dial it down for a week, but dial it up a little bit, you know?
That's beautiful, and I love what you said. What is your activist bliss? That is, I want a T-shirt. That is so fantastic.
Adam Schiff talks about this, and I think it's lovely. Who I adore. I love Adam Schiff. I think he's a national hero.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah.
I wish I could just put my finger on a button and make him the president of the United States.
Yes. Yeah, he's fantastic.
So one of the things I love about him is, and it's so antithetical to our culture right now, is he is so temperamentally poised.
Yes.
Even keeled.
Yep.
But
even when he's livid, you can see he's livid, but he's keeping it.
He is a measure twice, cut once kind of guy.
Yeah.
And I've heard him speak, and I've heard him say, "Look, it's not just Donald Trump. It's our culture. It's things that are systemically wrong. It's the fact that we no longer have the fairness doctrine, and the FCC is toothless. So we have, in essence, now a form of propagandistic media that doesn't care about fact, and we will consequently always have, until we figure out some structural solutions, this dialed up animus. It's being created by people who make money off of it. You can't live in a state of perpetual outrage. You've got to figure out the thing you can do that makes you feel better and that is giving back to your community. It is the only way you can find a form of peace that is actually proactive.
Yeah, I love the community word. That just hit me when you first said it earlier in the conversation too. That if we can reach out for somebody else's hands, even if community is just one other person, reaching out to grab somebody's hand so that you do feel like you are in community, even if it's only with one other person, helps manage the fear.
Yeah, because and could I say one thing that I think is is a practical, effective, fun, easy way to kind of begin to feel that in your life. Is because this is what push, all it did, I mean, it really did something just stupidly simple. It's just every other month, throw a party for your friends and ask each friend to bring a friend and ask people to make it a potluck, you know, put some booze on the table, and get to know people. Ask them to talk about the things they're doing in their community. You can't connect to people without making it a function of your life. And if you if you tie it to progressivism and you tie it to activism, but really loosely, you're not shoving anything down anybody's throat. You're just saying, come to a party with the intention of getting to know people who are doing things in their community. Maybe something will
God,
grab you.
Oh, my God, that's so cool. Yes, yes. And
anybody can do that.
Yeah, it's such a great idea. That's such a great thing to end on, too. But anything else that you want to say, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but that is just like so exalting and great, and I am going to say I'm so hesitant to do every other week, every other month, listen to me, like hedging, but I am going to commit to doing this once a quarter. That's what I'm committing to.
Yeah, and it does, the conceit behind push, you can be the next push party.
Yeah.
Push was basically, it's like, hey, you know, if you get a whole bunch of people who kind of agree very loosely to kind of pay attention to each other and come to events, you can swap off. I realize that it's tricky to kind of ask anybody to do anything that may require some sense of planning. So I just said, no, I'll do it. But a few people on the way have started throwing some parties. There's no timeline. Anybody can do it. For those folks who I think are looking for some way to goose themselves, just do it once. Just have a party with a bunch of your pals, but ask them to come prepared to talk about something they're doing.
Yeah, that's really, really beautiful. And I can't imagine that the angry hearts and the fearful hearts would both have a salve put on them after, you know, these parties. It's really great. And I watch when the launch of your push, the whole push movement is on YouTube, and I watched your introductory speech. And one of the things that I loved is you said, none of us knows what the fuck we're doing.
That's true.
So, just take the onus off of having it be anything in particular, just have it be people coming to share their passions.
I read this really beautiful quote the other day, and I can't remember who it was from, some doubtless prominent and famous activist. It might have been Martin Luther King. I can't recall. But it's something to the effect of, and I'm this is not analogizing to myself. I mean, I am like, you know, smaller than small potatoes. This just happens to be something that I have the time and the inclination to do. But I ain't no activist is a big word to me on a certain level, and really it needs to be honored. Those people who are true activists have changed the world in significant ways. I'm involved in my community. This is somebody who was a major activist, and he said the thing about activism that is that you're looking towards the horizon, and you're not looking down at your feet.
Ah!
When you're looking down at your feet and you're worried about where you're putting your next step, you're not striding. Real activists, they take strides because they see off on the horizon where they want to go.
Wow.
You know? And I think that's a beautiful animating principle for all of us that, you know, Beckett said, fail better. And I think that's all we can fucking do, you know, just take a whack. Push did not. And I remember there's a guy, and I had these meetings in my living room. There's one guy, really smart, nice guy, stayed very quiet. And I kind of finished blah, 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 and you know, people were responding. And the guy said, seems a little unfocused to me. And he's absolutely right. He was absolutely right. It was, and I look back on some of my initial thinking about it, and I think, you know, oh, you dimwit. But you don't get to step B without step A, and you don't get to step C without step B. It turned into something very different for me, and my life went in a different direction. But But now I'm working for a food coalition when I joined it that had a board of 7, and we're just about to seat a board of 20, and we've got 42 volunteer drivers. And, you know, I mean, it was a great organization doing great work. I don't mean to be trumpeting myself because there was a shitload of fucking cool stuff happening when I joined, but I feel like I was able to make a difference with an existing organization in my community doing great work, helping to bring volunteers in to solidify what they were already achieving so brilliantly.
That's sort of where
I come to. It's like, go out and find who's doing what interests you. Somebody's doing it.
Well, yeah, it's following your heart, right? I mean, but you follow your... So many people get inspired in their hearts. They have a feeling that they want to move towards something, but you actually get up off your haunch and move toward that thing to make a difference. I commend you for that.
Well, thanks. I think sometimes the problem is that when we kind of get this hunch that maybe we'd like to do something, we kind of are waiting around for somebody to kind of take us by the hand. And you know, unfortunately, there has to be a little bit of the initiator in all of us.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody's already doing the work. You don't have to start a not-for-profit. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You don't have to become, you know, all day, every day, ball-busting activist. Somebody else has got you covered. If you could just go out and kind of do a little sniffing around. Hey, here's an exercise that I used to dig. Take the New York Times for a week. Every day, read the New York Times and highlight the cool groups that you run across. There's always, like, you know, the blah, blah, blah organization fighting for yada, 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 the foundation for et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Always referenced in all these articles. At the end of the week, you'll see like hundreds and hundreds of cool, obscure, interesting groups that are basically fighting for cool shit that you never even would have heard of.
Oh, that's such a great exercise. That's awesome. Yeah.
Or another one that I think is important is like, this is an exercise I used to, when I was acting more, somebody would say, you know, write down either all the characters you've ever wanted to play or all the things that you'd be interested in exploring in yourself, and make that one of the things you strive to find in the jobs you search for. I think sometimes it's like, you know, you need to kind of interrogate yourself, put into a hat all the things that interest you, you know, put into a hat all the qualities that you dig in other people. Dig around in the hat, pull something out, and say my research project for the morning is to find organizations that will help me grapple with environment and issues of empathy. I don't know, you know.
That's great. That's a great exercise. Yeah.
It's just you kind of have to just kind of goose yourself a little bit more than I think we are used to doing.
I love it. I love it, John Billingsley. Thank you so much for coming.
Of course.
Cocksucker.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. I was just going to say, let me end this with cocksucker.
I've actually never said that before.
Oh, it's such a good word. I actually have been scored upon occasion I am on Facebook because I'm a great believer in profanity.
I am too.
But, you know, unfortunately, cocksucker has been pointed out to me that, you know, it is sort of a pejorative word that was traditionally used against the gay community. And so
oh, my gosh. I did not know that. Oh, my gosh. Now I feel horrible.
I know. You feel horrible. It's like it's my go-to fucking word.
Oh, my God.
You know, it's like, I'm sorry, my father was a gay sailor. The first word I learned was cocksucker. It's like, how can I strip cocksucker from my vocabulary?
Oh, my God. Okay, thanks for ending on a really depressing note.
Anytime. My pleasure.
All right, John Billingsley, thank you for inspiring us and giving us so many great, wonderful ideas.
Anytime, my pleasure. I look forward to seeing you soon. And I'll come to your party. You throw a party in 2 months. I'll come.
I will.
All right.
Okay, darling.
Okay.